This is a war memorial. In the next hour, you'll hear two stories recorded in Vietnam, one after the war and one during. I'm Alex Chadwick. You are hearing voices from NPR, the best of public radio. In 1966, a 19-year-old Marine took a reel-to-reel tape recorder with him into the Vietnam War. For 2 months, until he was killed in action, Lance Corporal Michael A. Baranowski made 3-inch open reel tapes of his friends, of life in foxholes, of combat. He sent these audio letters home to his family in Norristown, Pennsylvania. 34 years later, his friend and comrade, Tim Duffy, found those tapes. Here, then, are the Vietnam tapes of Lance Corporal Michael A. Baranowski, as remembered by his friend Tim Duffy, and produced by Christina Egloff with Jay Allison.
Every death is a tragedy, and I don't buy into any given death was more tragic than the others, okay? But in this, of all the 58,000 tragedies, this is one that's very close to me.
I don't know where to begin. There's so much to tell you about. We've been real lucky with the rain so far. It's rained only about 4 of the days we've been here. And the rest of the time we've been busy every hour, every minute with setting in and digging in, preparing fields of fire, clearing fields of fire, patrolling, ambushing, standing 50% security at night, stringing up barbed wire, trip flares, and other goodies. The terrain is majestic. It's like something out of Heidi. The view is magnificent. And just as sinister as it is magnificent. Sinister because this is the perfect terrain, the perfect country for mortar attacks. And the VC have made use of it.
My name is Tim Duffy. At the time I was in Vietnam, I was Corporal Tim Duffy, United States Marine Corps, 2199108. Mike, at the time, was Lance Corporal when we were together in October and November of 1966.
Here's another man you'll get to know through the tapes here, if I'm able to hang on to the recorder. Mr. Tim Duffy.
I got to know Mike back in Okinawa. He introduced himself one night.
We met in Okinawa in September of 1966. Then we took the USS Iwo Jima down to Vietnam. Then we moved up to what was called Payable Hill, which was located between the rock pile and the Razorback, approximately 4,000 to 5,000 yards south of the demilitarized zone in Quang Tri Province. And early on, I was sitting in on my rack writing a letter to my parents, and I looked up and I saw guy playing with a tape recorder. He saw me looking at him, and I'll be doggone, he stood up, walked down, and says, "Hi, my name's Mike Baranowski."
I have the recorder here, and I'm going to try to keep it elevated off the ground and away from everything here. I'm going to try to keep it up in the air, because everything I touch here eats through my skin or bites me or rots something. This is something else. The grass will cut you. The mud will rot your skin. This is something else.
We're in my bunker, or actually not even the bunker, because the Marine Corps calls them fighting holes, dug down into the side of the mountain, into the mud, and with a mud bench and a grenade sump. In case a grenade lands, you kick it down under a hole in the floor. And what we would do was, during the day, you had some free time if you were not on patrol or on operation. You'd have like 4 hours on and 4 hours off hole watch during the day. So if Mike happened to have his free time while I'm on hole watch, he would come down with his tape recorder and we would tape while I'm on hole watch.
This is the 35-watt voice of station MOXE, broadcasting to you from the swamps, jungles, boondocks, and infected salad of Fort McCourt, home of the fighting 1st Platoon of Hungry Eye Company, 3rd Battalion, 3rd Marines, defensive perimeter, just north of the rock pile and just south of the demilitarized zone of Vietnam. This is Watered Concrete in New York with the late world news.
Washington,
From the nation's capital...
I remember taping that comedy session, and we did it in my fighting hole, and I can see him sitting there doing that tape.
This portion of our programming is brought to you by 20 Round Burst, the candy bar voted best tax waste of the war.
Mike had made me go out and buy a harmonica, and he gave me one lesson, how to hold my tongue and play one note at a time. But he knew he wanted background music for all this crazy crap, so he, you know, made me learn how to, quote, play the harmonica. And that's me in the background with the Marine Corps hymn.
Don't be one of those unfortunates who suffer tragically from that malady sometimes referred to as Viet Cong yellow-striped fever. Stoop, stoop, stupefy your friends and maim your enemies. Exercise your God-given right to kill or maim at a distance. It's a great feeling to know that you can wipe out your entire neighborhood. Yes, be the first kid on your block to rule the world. See your Marine Corps recruiter today.
I really think Mike and I were just such kindred spirits, you know. Ironically, I don't ever remember us sitting around talking about the potential that one of us would die. You know, we just were not sitting there waiting to die.
I just don't know what to say. I'm a total loss for words here. I'm looking out of a window now, a hole in the sandbag wall in the back of the hooch. Looking out toward the east, out toward home. Long way from home. Actually, I guess home is closer straight down. It'll be great to hear your voices again. I can't wait to get a tape. Make sure that when you send a tape, it's on a 2-inch.
Just sitting here listening to your tapes while we had breakfast. Terry, Mom, Cookie, and myself came up to Scranton. Sandy worked all day yesterday.
Hi, Mike. Trying to straighten up, get ready for Thanksgiving. And I'm starting to get Daddy's lunch or dinner ready. He eats his dinner about 12 o'clock. So when I prepare his, I prepare for the whole family.
Yesterday, Mom took me to see Mary Poppins. And that was a really good movie. I enjoyed it very much. So take care of yourself and don't do anything I wouldn't do, as everybody in school says. Bye, Terry.
Hi, Mike. It's Cookie. So I came in to say a few words of hello to brighten your day. So I'll see you, Mike.
And I appreciate you sending the money home, Mike, but I can't. It just doesn't seem right for me to spend your money, so I opened an account. And I'm putting the money that you sent home to me into the bank for you when you get home. I wish that you could be home for Christmas. That'd be the greatest thing in the world.
Everybody's anxious to get home, get back to their families and their girls. But while we're over here, we're not wasting away thinking about it. We're glad and proud in a way that's different than the pride you usually think of. I don't know, it's difficult to explain. Maybe I can do a better job on another tape sometime. This is where I belong, I think. More so than any place else.
These tapes, I assumed these tapes were long gone. I never even considered the possibility they'd still be around. Then I met Cookie in 97, and I couldn't believe that she had those tapes. I personally think that what he did with the tape recorder was practice. I think it would have been his portfolio when he came home. You know, he was going in radio when he came home, and he was just going to take that around and play it and say, see, this is what I can do.
The rest of the tape here on this side are sounds as they recorded them when they called 100% alert, which is pretty rare. Now the word's been passed to fix bayonets.
Sarge just came running by and said, let me go get my bayonet so I can get it on this. This started to be a fun tape. I don't, it's getting too much like a 12-cent combat comic book now.
It's always fun when you kill people.
Yeah.
The attack was officially, I guess, referred to as a probe. So what the NVA were doing is they were looking for a weakness. And that whole battle was taking place 30 yards from Mike and I.
Hey, Carter. How many of you over there? Three of you? Three of you in that hole? Okay.
Now, there's all kinds of garbage going on. We don't know whether it's outgoing or incoming. No word's passed down like that. The illumination is being kept up, and every once in a while, a 60-millimeter mortar mission is called out to our left front, whole mountain out there. In front of us looks like a 9-acre Christmas tree. Fire. Another Peter. High explosive. Now you can hear the illumination being kept up there. Those were heat rounds, high explosive. It's dark now. We're waiting for the illumination to go off. That's a hairy thing. Hairy feeling, sitting there in the dark with all that stuff going on. Sounds of the Enchanted Forest.
Look out, Jesus! That's too close.
Airstrike.
Wipe napalm all over that place. Look at that. Generation.
I don't see any indication of fear in his voice. We didn't know but what we were going to have to grab our rifles and M14 or and grenades and have at it, because if they'd have broken through that point, then we were going to be in an all-out hand-to-hand combat. And that very potential, there was no way I could have stood there and did what he did.
Now it's dark, quiet. Everything's been quiet for about 15 minutes now. I was just crouching down in the hole there, talking to a hand grenade. I thought it was the microphone. I realized what I was doing. And the rain's just on time. Now it'll rain the rest of the night.
My memories of how Mike died are, he was walking point, and I was in a squad. I was carrying a radio, and I was probably five or six people back. And we were moving alongside of a Vietnamese village, and the village was deserted. And I heard one shot, which we knew was not an M14. We knew it wasn't one of ours. And then two more shots, and basically that was the end of it, and somebody shouted Mike was down. And I ran up through the fence row, and I saw Mike laying off to the side on the ground. I moved up beside him, and in my memory, he was looking at me. And so I had to run off, and we dealt with the firefight. And then they had to set up perimeter security to bring in the medevac helicopters. And so thinking that Mike has been wounded, I'm sitting under the tree, and I'm kind of smiling to myself. Good, he's going home now. And I thought he had gotten the million-dollar wound. And I began to kind of, in my imagination, I could see myself driving across the Interstate 70, driving into Norristown. I pictured a house like I think he would live in. And I pictured myself walking up the sidewalk, and Mike sees me, and he comes running out the door in a big hug, and welcome home, and let's go to New York City. That was our dream. Then the helicopters land. I look up and I see four people, one on each ankle and wrist. Literally, they've lifted him up like a sack of potatoes. They're running across the field. His head was hanging back, bouncing across the dirt. And I started to stand up and say, that's no way to treat a wounded man. And boom. And I knew he wasn't wounded. I knew he was dead. If you were to take me back to the beginning of it and say, okay, now here's how it's going to end. Are you sure you want to do this? I think I'd still have to say, yeah, I want to do it again. And it's not the war, it's not the cause, it's not Vietnam, it's just the kind of love that you get in such a short, intense period of time. I think I can go to his grave now. I've never done it. Take a copy of the tape and just kind of dig a little hole there, and maybe we'll put a copy of the broadcast there for him. I don't know, but I think I'm going to have to go tell him that it worked, that he's been on the radio, and he made it.
Well, that's my hooch, but what I usually do is stumble around, and if I can find my way through the darkness, I come down here and sleep with my friends, the Arvins. What I think I'll do right now is I'll go down and talk to one of the men that's standing whole watch here on the hill. Who's here?
Oh, how you doing, man?
You tired?
No.
Not tired, huh?
No.
I thought it would be one of the Marines down in this hole. It's usually manned by a Marine. That's why you didn't hear the familiar halt, who goes there. This is one of my Arvin friends down here. His name is Nine. He's sitting here with his eyes half closed. The poor guy's been on watch. I don't know. How you doing, Nine?
Fine.
Yeah, fine. You look like you're about to fall over. He's just sitting here on the sandbags, right up on top. He doesn't care who's out there. Too tired to care about anything. Got the Muga? Muga? No. Kate Muga means maybe rain. And he doesn't think so. I don't think so either. There are a billion stars visible tonight. It's beautiful. Almost every night that's clear. And now more and more nights aren't clear because the monsoon is fast coming. But those nights that are clear, almost every star that's visible with a human eye, I guess, is visible. It's a beautiful sight. Milky Way and all the constellations. Of course, they're a little bit different now that we're on the other side of the planet and looking at them from some weird cockeyed angle, I don't know. Hey, I've got some news for you. I made meritorious Lance Corporal today. How about that? Proud of me? Anyway, the lieutenant handed me the paper and he said, congratulations, Lance Corporal Baranowski. And I didn't know what to say, so I didn't say anything. Wow. You see that shooting star, Nine? You see that? Whoosh. It was a big shooting star just now. And that was mortars. It just fired maybe 40 feet in back of me. This is so much easier than writing. You get all the right voice inflections, and I can do it in the dark, of course, which is nice, except that this damn red blinker here is liable to get me zapped, so I've got my hand over it. But I'm not quite as awake as I should be when I try to tape. But just wanted to get this one off to you while I can, so that you'll have it and know that I'm thinking about you. I think about all of you and miss you so much every day. You just don't have any idea
Mom and Dad, Cookie, Sandy, and Terry, how good it was to hear your voices again. It was really wonderful. That's all I can say. What else can I say? It was really great to hear you all again.
Vietnam Tapes of Lance Corporal Michael A. Baranowski was produced by Christina Egloff with Jay Allison in collaboration with the series Lost and Found Sound, with help from Art Silverman, Darcy Bacon, and Bill Deputy of NPR's All Things Considered. The Life Stories Collection comes from a radio series produced by Jay Allison with his friends and collaborators. The editor and co-producer is Christina Egloff. Brent Runyon made the compilation. The music comes from Benjamin Verdery and Friends. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. Our partnership with the Lost and Found Sound series received funding from those sources and also from the National Endowment for the Humanities, and it's produced by the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, Jay Allison Productions, and NPR. A CD anthology of the Life Stories Collection is available by calling toll-free 1-866-LIFE-STORY. Or you can find it on the web at jayallison.org. And if you have a life story, contact transom.org. Coming up, a return to Vietnam. That's in a minute on Hearing Voices.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
This is Hearing Voices with a war memorial, Return to Vietnam. I'm Alex Chadwick. We recorded this in a Catholic church in Hanoi, the capital of Vietnam, a church that survived the Christmas bombing during the war. Thank you. I first went to Vietnam in the 60s as a soldier stationed there. I went back to Vietnam 20 years later as a journalist. Back then, to get there, you had to go through Thailand.
Bangkok, a way stop on a journey of rediscovery which is about to begin. On a morning in early February, in the courtyard of a temple by a river, I come across a middle-aged man who claims to be the greatest fortune teller in the city. And because the outcome of this journey is uncertain, I ask about the future. He consults some charts, mutters, writes down some figures, and puts his pen aside. "Well," he says, "there are great strains ahead in relations and in work and reputation," he says. "Very great danger to reputation," he says. "And in fact, the prospects are for an immediate decline." I pay the man $4 and go away. The next day, I get on an airplane and fly into Vietnam.
The flight time will be 1 hour and 15 minutes. Please fasten your seatbelts.
The first time I went to Vietnam, I flew into the south and went to work in a city that officially doesn't exist anymore. But everything changes. This time the plane went north, and all through the hour-and-a-half flight, the land was obscured by clouds and rain, until at last we passed down through the gloom and emerged near our destination at about 2,000 feet. Immediately I look around for bomb craters, but I can't see any. Instead, the earth below is utterly flat, almost all farmland, broken into parcels, some of them quite small, only a few hundred square feet. The different patches are brown or yellow, or some a fresh green. There are clusters of buildings. Suddenly, the Hanoi airport. The jet zooms across the end of the runway. And out the window, there's a fast glimpse of the old Vietnam, the long barrel of an anti-aircraft gun, draped in camouflage nets and pointed at the sky. We stop. Down on the runway, a soldier wheels a metal staircase to the side of the plane. Almost now. Almost. People gather belongings and stand in the aisle, and the door opens to Vietnam. And it's cold, startling. I was never cold in Vietnam. The south is always hot. But this is gray and drizzly and cold. The airport building is unheated, dingy. Everything in it looks homemade. Immigration officers hold long conferences over small documents. What if you spent a year of the young part of your life in a strange, exotic place that tasted unlike anything you'd known, and then it was closed off to you, forever, you thought, and then open again? No one looks friendly, but I can recognize some of the words. It's Vietnamese. This really is Vietnam, however grim and unfamiliar. A water bottle carried in my backpack bursts and drains to the floor. Waiting in line to present my passport, I'm dripping, confused, exhilarated. Loudspeakers mounted on street poles in Hanoi broadcast a morning chime. The streets are empty at dawn, and 15 minutes later, they're crowded. A truck rolls past, sounding the horn to clear the way. Occasionally, there's a car, and there are some motorcycles, but almost anyone with anywhere to go rides a bicycle. Some corners have stoplights, but the lights don't work, and there are no stop signs, and in fact, no one ever stops. A truck might bully its way through, but the bicycles simply flow together at intersections. No direction ever halting for another, but all somehow blending. On foot, it's about 20 minutes from the hotel to some city offices near a lake. Along the way, people are bundled against the cold, but some are barefoot, and some don't have on enough to keep warm. There are cooking fires burning on the streets. Still, maybe the French were thinking of this city when they clung to Vietnam, thinking of the solid colonial buildings or the graceful tree-lined streets. I'd expected bombed rubble in Hanoi. Instead, there's scarcely any evidence of the war. It's beautiful, completely beautiful, and very poor.
Đúng hoàn toàn như ông nói. Đúng như ông nói đó. Chiến tranh xong rồi, chúng tôi nghĩ rằng là chỉ trong dòng 10 năm chúng tôi có thể đưa lại cho nhân dân những cái điều mà đảng đã muốn trong chiến tranh.
The deputy mayor of Hanoi, an economist, at his office in the city building by the lake. He's explaining the new Vietnam.
Cho nên là chúng tôi làm vụ.
After peace was established, we wanted to give the people within 10 years all the things that the party had promised them. So we hurried, made mistakes on many things. Now we are very aware how difficult it is to rebuild our country, perhaps more so than fighting or ending a war.
The population grows rapidly in Vietnam, but the economy stagnates. Things aren't working. In Hanoi, the electricity is apt to flicker off in whole sectors of the city and stay off for hours. Schools are crowded. Students go in shifts. School buildings are unrepaired. People say openly they don't have enough money and can't earn enough by legal means. A question of money and legality arises immediately for any visitor. The Vietnamese currency is called the dong. You can convert dollars to dong at any government exchange at the official rate. But it's easy to do much better. In any neighborhood in downtown Hanoi, through the front room of a shop and down a dim corridor, shopkeepers pursue a second line of work in a back room, currency trading.
Can we change all our money?
Yes, please.
How much, what's the rate these days?
1,026.
1,026?
Yes.
Maybe change $80?
Yes, okay.
On the black market, the price of a dollar changes from day to day, but it's always 3.5 or 4 times the government rate, and the opportunity to quadruple their money is something very few foreigners pass up.
1,000 and 800.
It's not legal, but it's so widely practiced that no one even attempts much of a disguise. If the government really wanted to stop it, it could, but the dollars would disappear into hiding, and the dong would be hoarded, and getting tough wouldn't be much good for anyone. Harsh, useless lessons are frowned on now. They're outdated, consigned to the old Vietnam. The new Vietnam is nowhere better displayed than at Hanoi's Central Market. The indoor part is a huge, cavernous space, dimly lit again. There aren't any bright lights in Vietnam, but it's jammed with people on a Saturday morning. Some of the counters and shelves here belong to state-run or government stores, but there's not much worth buying there, and the shoppers are going elsewhere, to private stalls that are loaded with goods.
How long have you had your shop here?
It's been 5 months already.
5 months. What made you start? How did you get started?
The government says it's okay for the people to open shops now.
This woman's in business for herself, selling fabric from a countertop covered with bolts of cloth. She buys the material from local village cooperatives whose members work extra hours to earn more money. The merchant is then free to set her own price and keep her profits, though she's heavily taxed.
Were you ever in business before?
No.
I think it takes courage to start a business.
I have to stick my neck out to do this. I don't know whether I will win or lose.
A lot of people taking chances today to make money?
Many are doing the same before there were few, but now because the government openness, we all coming out to sell.
As in many other communist countries, Vietnam is experimenting with some forms of capitalism in the hope of restarting its stalled economy. The government doesn't really like having to do this,
it should be able to manage all these enterprises without a lot of profit-making merchants. But it hasn't figured it out yet, and people are tired of waiting. Through big open archways at the back of the market building, there are more stalls outside in a shaded area where cooperatives can sell extra produce beyond that which they owe the government in exchange for feed and seed and fertilizer. We're covered by a sort of an awning, but it's a pretty substantial awning. Big wooden post supporting a roof made of tile, I think. Can't quite tell from underneath it here. Anyway, it runs up against this old market building, big open building. And under this roof here, strung out all along the side of the building, is stall after stall of food. The front row is all fresh vegetables laid out, onions and lettuce, beets, grapefruits that are just huge. Here's fresh pineapple. Fresh pineapple for sale for 50 don, and I just happen to have 60 don right here. Pineapple with brown sugar sprinkled onto it. God. It's not sugar. It's salt. But it's very good. In all this abundance, it's difficult to believe that Vietnam is one of the five poorest countries in the world. But the Vietnamese themselves say it is so. And many of them live so close to desperation that there doesn't appear to be much room for things to get worse. They worry all the time about how to make some money. Tourism.
Okay, I just want to let you know the arrangements for tomorrow morning. It's a 6 o'clock call. We'll be catching the same flight that we came in on yesterday that will continue on to Ho Chi Minh City.
Okay.
Okay?
No problem. Momentarily.
Western tourists spend a lot of money and like remote, unusual places.
We've already seen the One War Museum, and this might be just a repetition. Looking in through the doors, the tanks and other pieces of equipment that we had seen. I think it was in Hue. Was that where the Army Museum was? Da Nang or Hue?
In Hanoi.
In Hanoi. Mm-hmm. Okay. And we did an extensive tour of that museum.
Whatever the country's sad past involvement with Western foreigners, the new Vietnam is now very eager to see more of them as tourists. Even Americans, maybe especially Americans, are welcome.
They seem very friendly.
We expected to find some of that anti-American, had nothing, absolutely nothing.
They'd ask, you know, who are you? Where are you from? And you say America, and they just break out in a big grin. They try and say a few words in English.
Doesn't that seem funny to you? I mean,
I didn't expect it.
You just see happy, friendly people.
But there are odd encounters waiting for an American. The old Vietnam, right out in the noonday sun of the new. I stayed one day at a government tourist hotel on a beach near the city of Da Nang, which is about halfway down Vietnam's coast. Many tourists stop at the place. A lot of journalists do, too. The beach is medium wide, probably 200 feet from the dune ridge to the edge of the surf. The sand is pale yellow, almost as fine as dust. The waves come in, steady, steady, shelf after shelf of water, a constant roar. Way off to the north, miles away, a spine of mountains runs out to the sea and plunges down. I walked south late in the afternoon, the beach absolutely deserted, a little haze. When the sun began to go down, the air turned golden. Tourists will come here and think there's no other place like it. There's nothing missing. Not even cows. A herd of cows came walking down the beach, some old women and children with them. Cows, absurd and out of place on a beach. Where some fishing boats were pulled up above the reach of the tide,
The herd turned inland, and I followed along, over the ridge, to a path that led down through scrub pine. Right there was a large oval mound of sand, raised up a little, and with nothing growing on it. It's a grave, someone said, although there wasn't a marker or anything. A little ways on, the path came out in a village, where the cows belonged. It looked poor. There were some small peasant houses. They were growing vegetables and tobacco. It was almost dark by this time, but everyone came out to see the stranger who'd come home with the herd.
Is this a fishing village? Do a lot of people fish here?
Yes, this is a fishing village.
How's the fishing now?
We've got to wait for the start of the rainy season. Before we fish a lot. But now we are too old.
And then a question, meant innocently. What did you do during the war?
This whole place was a Viet Cong territory. Over there were straw huts run by the Viet Cong. The American hit us with bombs and everything else, burned the whole village.
Did that make you join the side of the Viet Cong, or did that make you tell the Viet Cong to go away because you were afraid the Americans might come and bomb again?
We all follow the Viet Cong.
Listen, here in the center of the country, we were all Viet Cong from the day we were born. When the Americans came, they tried to move us all out, but we put up a fight, so they used force.
But we wouldn't go.
We didn't care if they hurt us. We struggled to stay with our land.
How many villagers were killed here?
Oh, many, many over there.
The young people, that's where many were killed. The young people, others, maybe 100. The Viet Cong were underground building bunkers. They never finished them. The Americans came, they fought, and our people died.
You know that there's talk that they're going to build more tourist hotels down there and bring in more tourists, and people in the city have told me they want American tourists to come here. What do you think of that?
During the war, they were the enemy, but now we can be friends. Now we want peace. The Americans aren't the enemy anymore.
But you say that they killed 100 people in this village?
Yeah, during the war, but it's different now.
During the war, if the Americans didn't attack the liberation forces, would have attacked them. But now, between our two peoples, there's no problem. No problem at all.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Goodbye.
New Year's Eve in Ho Chi Minh City, alias Saigon. They love fireworks here. On New Year's, a family will go through a small arsenal of explosives. Bang, 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 all night long. I remember New Year's Eve. The Lunar New Year, was the middle of February this year. They call it Tet. I remember 20 years ago here, the same thing. Bang, 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 all night long. Sometime around dawn back then, the firecrackers turned into hand grenades and bullets. Fires broke out. We hadn't thought that the war could come to the city, but it did. We didn't grasp it at the time, but we were losing. Some people think it was already lost by full light on that very day. Anyway, two decades have gone by, and it's Tet again, and in the same city. But now renamed for the great engineer and planner and inspiration of its liberation. A lot of people still call it Saigon. But it's a different city, of course. And it's funny, but it takes a couple of days to recognize the difference. The war's gone. The guns, the soldiers everywhere, the helicopters scraping over rooftops, all the nervous exhaustion and bravado and terror, all gone. And in their place, a sense of peace. The south part of Vietnam is said to be a place where people still remember how to make money, wealthier than the north. There are more signs of wealth, more cars, more motorbikes. At night, teenagers cruise around the city on new Hondas. But there's greater poverty, too. There are more beggars. They besiege foreigners on the street. There are more half-naked children, more people just sitting around, apparently with nothing to do. And naturally, there are many more veterans from the losing side of the war, so you can hear more dissatisfaction.
There are so many people in house, no house. There are so many people living outside the street. So many people have not enough rice to eat. Because everything, day and day, get more and more expensive.
The new Vietnam needs more jobs, more wealth, and it's going to take more than tourism to produce them. The new Vietnam is saying to capitalists, to those who want to try capitalism, that it's okay again. And there are very favorable deals offered to foreign businessmen who might build factories in Vietnam, or buy lumber, or bauxite, or fish, or anything else that the Vietnamese can produce right now. The Japanese are already in Vietnam. The Koreans are coming. And an official from the press office is happy to arrange for a Western journalist to interview one of the leading economic theorists of the new Vietnam, a man so Western in outlook himself that he even has a Western name, Jack Owen.
My job is to improve the working of the economy with the kind of mechanism which I know best, which is what I have learned in the capitalistic type of economics. Of course, here you are not given the freedom to choose. Either you would have an economy or you would have a socialistic economy. From my point of view, I do not have that freedom at the moment.
His real name is Nguyen Xuan Won, but back at Harvard 30 years ago, when he was getting his MBA, no one could pronounce Nguyen Xuan Won, so he just called himself Jack Owen. Later, he was a banker and a film producer. He's married to a movie star. And he was an important man in the government of South Vietnam, important enough to get arrested when the present government took over. His arrest didn't last long. Instead, the party leaders started listening to his advice. He says their policies are scattered and unrealistic. He thinks the government must be tougher, that people are frittering away money that could be spent usefully. In Jack Owen, Nguyen Xuan Won, the old Vietnam and the new Vietnam meet.
I don't like to see these new cars running in the street. If I were in the government, I would have stopped them.
New cars?
There's no place for them in this country yet. All this could be saved to import the raw materials, the equipment for production. You can't count very easily thousands of new cars in this country. They are not needed.
So you want to get that money out of, you want to get the money that people are spending on cars, mm-hmm. get it into
production.
Production.
Exactly. You see.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The people don't like it because it is as much political as economic problems, but we have to do it.
A few days after Tet this year, there was an article about fireworks in the local newspaper. It said the recent celebrations had killed 27 people and cost 1 billion dong, and that this was wasteful. Perhaps Tet will change. Perhaps there will be fewer fireworks in the new Vietnam. I saw the economist, Jack Owen, again. I was walking back to my hotel one day, and he was just leaving it. He was with a Japanese businessman I'd seen around. The government relies on Jack Owen to meet with these foreign businessmen. He understands them, and they're comfortable with him. The two men were saying their goodbyes out by the curb. They shook hands, and Jack Owen, wearing a well-cut tan suit, got into the back of his shiny new Toyota, and the driver started it up and drove away. Going down the block, the car passed a side entrance to the hotel, an entrance closed off by a metal grill. A hedge blocked the view from the street, but there was a young woman there, slumped down against the steel rods of the grill, almost collapsed in the corner. There were small children all around her. Maybe too many to all be hers, but who else's? She was dirty and looked worn out. She was just waiting, quietly, and the children with her. Waiting for a generous foreigner with some spare change, for the new prosperity, for the new Vietnam. Our story on Vietnam was produced by Art Silverman, edited by John McChesney, and recorded and mixed by Flawn Williams. I'm Alex Chadwick. This is HearingVoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of SoundImagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is HearingVoices.com.